What was it like to hear about the JFK assassination? Or America's triumph over Hitler? We're seeing Queen at Live Aid. Our past is a collection of stories that bring us to now. Welcome to the Eyewitness History Podcast, where we view history through the eyes of the people that watch the events that shaped our world. Here's your host, Josh Cohen, and these are their stories.
Hello, listeners. Thank you for tuning in to the Eyewitness History Podcast. In the world of technology and innovation, few names are as legendary as Steve Jobs. He was not only a visionary, but a force of nature who reshaped entire industries. And today, we have the privilege of speaking with someone who not only worked alongside Steve Jobs, but played an instrumental role in bringing his revolutionary ideas to the world. Our guest is Andrea Cunningham, or Andy. She is a marketing and communications trailblazer who joined the ranks of Regis McKenna in the heart of Silicon Valley. It was here that she found herself at the epicenter of innovation and was given project lead responsibilities that would forever change the course of her career. Andy collaborated with Steve Jobs on the launch of the Apple Macintosh, an endeavor that would become a milestone in tech history. She didn't just witness the birth of the Macintosh, she was a key architect of its success. And that's just the beginning of her incredible journey. After her time with Apple, she ventured into the uncharted territory of Next, Steve Jobs' ambitious project that would pave the way for future innovations. And from there, she continued her remarkable career with Pixar, another brainchild of Jobs himself. Today, we'll delve into those captivating stories, insights, and adventures of Andy Cunningham during her time working alongside Steve Jobs at Apple, Next, and Pixar. We'll uncover the behind-the-scenes moments, the challenges, and the triumphs that defined an era of innovation. And now I give you Andy Cunningham.
Hi, everyone. If you've been injured in an accident that was not your fault, listen up. We have legal professionals standing by to answer your questions for free. Call now and find out if you have a case and how much it's potentially worth. Call 800-218-6010. I'm here with spokesman John Wolf. So, John, tell everyone listening who should call right now.
Well, Maria, first off, thank you for having me here. It's always nice to answer the listeners' questions. Now, as far as who should call in, anyone who's been injured in an accident and think you deserve compensation, give us a call right now. 800-218-6010. You'll find out if you have a case and how much it's potentially worth.
Thanks, John. You heard it, folks. Take advantage of this opportunity and call now. 800-218-6010.
Advertisement sponsored by Legal Help Center may not be available in all states.
Okay, I'm here with Andrea Cunningham. Andy, thanks for coming on the podcast.
Thank you. It's really great to be here.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to have you here. I really appreciate you coming on. Obviously, I want to discuss you, Steve Jobs, Apple. We'll track through all of it. Before we do, please tell our listeners briefly who you are and what you do.
Sure. So my name is Andy Cunningham, Andrea, for long, and I have been a marketing person in Silicon Valley since 1983, and I currently have a agency or a firm, if you will, that does positioning, messaging, and go-to-market planning for mostly technology-oriented companies, which, of course, these days is everyone. So,
yes, indeed. Thank you, Andy. I appreciate it. So winding the clock back, I'd love to ask you, what was it that compelled you to pursue a career in marketing and communications?
So that is going way back. So I am from Chicago. I was working at a trade magazine in Chicago called Fleet Maintenance and Specifying. So I got to write about lubricating truck parts mostly. And I was beginning to realize I was not going to make enough money in that career in order to live. So because I had to actually, I was also a roller skating hostess at a restaurant at the same time because I had to have two jobs in order to live. So I wanted to only have one job. So I started the process of kind of looking for other things to do. I went and I interviewed at Playbill magazine, which is what it was called at the time, that little booklet you get when you go to a Broadway show. Mm-hmm. And I thought that would be really fun to write there. And the woman who was the editor at the time said to me, I can't pay you much more. And I think you could probably do a lot more. So I would recommend this recruiter person that for you to meet and see what happens there. And I said, you know, thank you. I really appreciate that. So I met with the recruiter. He said, you would be awesome in PR. And he introduced me to two agencies, Burson Marsteller being one, Edelman being the other. And I ended up getting a job offer at both, but I took the one at Burson Marsteller, and that sort of launched me in this career of communication and communication strategy. And that was in Chicago. They threw me onto the tech companies because, not that there were a lot of tech companies back in 1981,
right,
but the things that were more technical, I guess I would say, because I'd been, you know, I'd been writing about truck technology, if you will. And so some of those companies were really cool, like Atari was one of them. I also worked with a company called Bell & Howell, which produced educational hardware. They are the only company who ever remarketed the Apple II computer. So they had they bought a bunch of Apple IIs. They took off the beige cover, replaced it with a black cover, and called it the Black Apple in the market. So I got very excited about this Apple II computer. My boss started to put a whole bunch of articles on my desk about Silicon Valley because he could see how excited I was. The client actually gave me one of these computers. And so I became enamored with Silicon Valley, and Burson Marsteller decided to open up an office in Silicon Valley, and I flew out to interview to work there. I decided that I'd take the extra few hours in the day to see if I could meet with other agencies as well. So I did. I found Regis McKenna. I got to meet with Regis, and he offered me the job on this to run the launch of the Macintosh for his agency. So I took that job. That's how I got here.
Excellent, Andy. No, thank you for running through all that. I appreciate it. And actually, you allow me a really smooth transition into my next question. So yes, if my notes are correct here, Andy, it was 1983. You moved to Silicon Valley and, as you say, joined Regis McKenna. You were then given, if my notes are correct here, project lead responsibilities to work with Steve Jobs on the launch of the Macintosh. Bobby can anticipate my question from here. What was it like when you first met Steve Jobs, and what responsibilities did you have in working with him?
Well, I'll start with the responsibilities first. So I was the account manager. I don't know what the title was, but I managed the Apple account at Regis McKenna. So we had, unfortunately, at the time, they had just launched the Lisa computer. Mm-hmm. And the entire Regis McKenna team, except for one person, quit right after that.
Wow.
Which is why Regis was very excited to get somebody on board who understood a little bit about technology, because he didn't have a team. And the other person who was still left at Regis was probably 2 years younger than me. I was already very young, but she was 2 years younger than I. So I was 26. She was probably 24, maybe 23. And so he was looking for somebody. And that's really, I think, why I ended up getting a job. But all of the people who were working on the Lisa had quit because it was kind of a failed computer, a failed launch, a failed computer. And it was very depressing for everybody. So my responsibilities were to build up a team to serve Apple. I was the Apple account manager. And of course, the most important thing to do at that time was launch Macintosh. So that's what we did. We put all of our efforts into that. We didn't really spend much time on the Apple II at the time. And I showed up at work every day with this other woman, Jane, who was an awesome partner to me. And we actually showed up at Apple every day. We got there at 8 a.m. and left at about 10 at night every day for 6 months.
Wow.
So anyway, those were my responsibilities. And I ended up growing the account team to be quite large. We probably had 20 people on the account by the time I left 2 years later. So we built it into a large piece of business for Apple, bigger than it had ever been. And it was just great fun. We had a great time. So the other part of your question, what was it like when I met Steve? It was pretty amazing. I mean, he was an amazing marketing genius. And that's really what I feel like I learned from him a lot. But I mean, I would ask him all kinds of interesting questions. Like I remember one time I said, hey, Steve, you know, what is it that you think is the special thing about Macintosh, right? What's the thing that you really want to come out in the communication stuff that we're working on? And he said, well, I want people to feel like there is a mother in every box, that they get the box and they open it up and then it just takes care of you, right? Like your mother would. That's a very sweet analogy, you know, I thought. And he had very interesting perspectives on many things. And I enjoyed learning those from him. He was very difficult, though. He took every opportunity to, you know, to berate you, throw things at you, scream at you if you didn't do exactly what he felt should be done. And all of us were very young, including him. He was 2 years older than me, but everybody was around our age. We were all in our 20s, all of us. And there were 100 people working in the Mac building. And those 100 people knew that they were there to help Steve change the world. And if we stopped at any point helping him change the world in his eyes, then he got rid of you. So we were all very anxious and also excited about the role we were playing in changing the world and whatever that we did. So we stuck with it. And all those 100 people still kind of have a relationship today.
Incredible. Thank you, Andy, for running through that. I appreciate it. And yeah, I want to talk a little bit about his, let's call it personality quirks in a minute. It's legendary. But I'd love for you, Andy, to talk a little bit deeper to the extent that you hadn't already about, yes, launching that Mac, the Macintosh, of course, and then how it felt after, because clearly the branding on it paid off, yeah?
Yes, but not for a long time, not for over 10 years. So one of the interesting things about the Mac launch is that it was probably the most successful launch in history for on two fronts. One, that ad, that 1984 ad, which is still the most famous ad ever.
Yep.
Lee Scott. Really tipped the scales, you know, in the awareness generation of Apple and Macintosh. That was a brilliant piece of work. I had nothing to do with it, but that was a brilliant piece of work by a day. But the other side, which we did have a lot to do with, was the PR front. So we had a strategy to try to get as many journalists to touch and feel Macintosh as we possibly could do back in the day. And there was no Zoom. There was no video conferencing. There were no cell phones. There was none of this stuff. So Jane and I sat down and came up with a list of 100 journalists that we felt could influence the world. And we flew them in to Apple one at a time, pretty much one at a time. So on any given day at Apple, there would be at least two journalists in. And we gave them a whole program of education. So they had an hour in the factory. They had an hour with the product team. They had an hour with Steve. They had an hour with John Sculley, who was the CEO at the time. They had an hour with the international person, Joanna Hoffman, who has the her Kate Winslow played her in the movie. And so by the time they left at the end of the day, they had a full on idea of what Apple and Macintosh was all about. And then we skewed each set of interviews for each reporter so that we wound up at the end of the day with lots of different kinds of stories written about Macintosh when it launched. So we got the cover of numerous publications, including Rolling Stone, and we had all different articles in all of them, you know, with different angles on the story. So it was a very successful launch from a PR perspective as well as an advertising perspective. However, it didn't take off as a product. It was not selling. And I remember 100 days in, when we thought we would have traction in sales, we discovered we didn't. So we came up, this was not me, this was the marketing manager, a guy named Mike Murray, came up with an idea to create a program called Test Drive a Macintosh. So the Macs were at these dealers at the time, which was Businessland, Computerland, and those old-fashioned companies that nobody has anymore. And we did a deal with them that you could take a Mac home for a week, you know, figure out how to use it, play with it, and then bring it back to the dealership. So it was called Test Drive a Macintosh. And it was a great campaign, and the advertising for it was great and all that, but not that many people were taking them home and using them. And even those who were taking them home were not making a decision to buy them. So the product was actually starting to fail. And this is actually the reason that Steve ultimately got fired from Apple. It's because he insisted that investment continue to be made in Macintosh. And he insisted that the product remain a viable thing inside the company, but it was losing money. And at that time, the company was going through other financial challenges. And Steve became very emotional about this and insistent upon it. And they just decided to fire him in a board meeting because he was being belligerent and being Steve. Now, interestingly enough, after Steve left and he was gone for 8 years, the interesting thing about it is that they never did kill Macintosh. You know, I kind of thought they would have, but they never did. And I think perhaps a man named Jean-Louis Gasset, who was the guy who ran France for us, who was fabulous, is fabulous. I think it's probably thanks to him that it didn't get killed at the end of the day. But at any rate, it just hobbled along for 8 years. During those 8 years, though, Steve is watching what's going on with Macintosh really closely from the sidelines, from Next, right?
Yep.
Which also turned out to be a failure, by the way. But he's watching what's going on with Macintosh. And what he's noticing is that it's slowly creeping into the office market, to the business market, but it's coming in through a very interesting angle. It's the people in the creative departments that are recognizing what they can do creatively with bitmap graphics, which was the first computer to have them, really, commercial computer. And they were sneaking the computer into their office through the back door. And they'd almost like put it under their coat and bring it in and sit it on their desk, use it during the day, and then take it home at night. So they were basically going against the IT policies at their companies by bringing in this Macintosh. But they could do more creative things with it. And slowly, slowly, Macintosh started to move out from the circle of creatives to marketing people, and then from marketing people to HR people, and then from HR, and it kind of had this very slow sort of spread, if you will, inside the enterprise. And by this time, it was about 8 years later when Steve decided that he could sell Next to Apple, which would be a great excuse for him to get back into the company. He always wanted to get back into the company and run it. In fact, the day that I started working with him after he left Apple, I went home and told my husband he'll be back at Apple, because he just desperately wanted to prove that he could do this thing. So he came back 8 years later through the excuse of having Apple buy the Next product. Also, Apple was failing too at this time because they'd gone through a couple of different CEOs, neither of which were able to do anything with the company. So he comes back, but now he's back with a lot of new knowledge. The knowledge, he's a better leader, he's a better manager, he's 8 years older, and he knows who's using Macintosh. So this is when he figures out that it's the creative people that needs to create a tribe out of, right? So he recognizes that and begins to create a tribe around that. And then there was that other amazing advertising campaign called Here's to the Crazy Ones. And I think you recognize that. So you know,
oh, yes. Richard Dreyfuss and the rest of it. Yep.
Another amazing ad, right? But what that did is it made you feel that if you are a little bit of a misfit, you're just like Albert Einstein or Richard Dreyfuss or any of these people.
Gandhi.
John Lennon, exactly. So with that ad, he connected with this tribe of people who wanted to identify with something that was bigger than themselves. And that was these other crazy people. And then the whole thing just took off, right? So he really did it through understanding who is buying the product, who is using the product, how to build a tribe out of them, how to connect with them. And that's pretty much been the strategy from the get-go, or not the get-go, but from when he came back to Apple. So anyway, long way of saying that's what happened.
No, excellent, Andy. Thank you for running through it. I appreciate it. I mean, I do want to track through Next shortly here because there's some interesting discussions there as well. Yeah, a lot has been said about Jobs' personality and management style. Walter Isaacson's book that came out dwelled on that quite a bit. You know, the reality distortion field and so on.
Yep.
Is brought up a lot. So I'm curious, to the extent that you haven't discussed it already, how you saw him and if there was a particular encounter with him that stands out for you.
Oh, I had multiple encounters with Steve. Multiple. I could go on for hours about that. But let me just first comment on the reality distortion field.
Yeah.
The reality distortion field was a very sincere belief that you could make anything happen if you just put your mind to it. And that kind of drove Steve with everything that he did. So the reality distortion field was, if he thinks that something is possible, you better figure out how to do it. If you're part of his team. And those of us who were able to stick around long enough were able to break through that reality distortion field by showing him that you actually could do something. And there's a famous story, and it's in the movie, where Andy Hertzfeld is told by Steve, literally shortly before the Mac launch, he's told by Steve, you got to make this thing talk. And by God, several hours later, when he opened up the stage, took the cover off Macintosh, and it said hello in a few other words. And that was just how Steve rolled, right? If I think it's possible, you can make it happen. So there were many, many moments with Steve that I remember. I'll tell you a couple stories. And
by all means.
Yeah. You know, go on. But one of them was to sort of accentuate, if you will, his personality. So one of the great things about Steve is he was able to understand how critical an environment is for the success of something to happen, for you to psychologically manipulate the mind of the person that you're with. They have to be in an environment in which that is possible, right? That's only part of the game, but a big important part of the game. So one of the things we did before we ever brought any press around Steve is we would get into this hotel room, and he loved the Carlyle Hotel in New York, and because it had so much character. John Scully never wanted to stay there. John stayed at the Helmsley Palace, but Steve always stayed at the Carlyle. And so I kind of became Steve's handler, and my friend Jane became John's handler. So I would show up with Steve after a flight from California. We'd land around 10 o'clock. We'd show up at the suite at about 11. He was at the top penthouse. But he didn't stay in that suite. That was just for showing the stuff to the press. But we got in there and everything had to be changed. He had to rearrange the furniture. We had to order a certain kind of flowers. There's a piece about this in the movie. He insisted on getting calla lilies, but he didn't understand what a calla lily looked like. I mean, he knew the look of the flower he wanted. He didn't know it was called a calla lily. So he and I get into this big argument at about 1 in the morning that I know what you want. You want calla lilies. They were all over my wedding. They're my favorite flower, too. Yes, I get what you... No, it's not a calla lily. It's not a calla lily. Anyway, there's a bit about that in the movie. I just said, fine. And then I ordered the calla lilies and we got... But I'm ordering flowers literally at 1 in the morning in New York for this one. We're getting certain kinds of strawberries to be delivered that had to have cream, but the cream had to be in a separate bowl. Both of these bowls had to be placed exactly right on the grand piano that he had moved into the room. The furniture had to be... Everything had to be moved and changed and dealt with. And at about 3 in the morning, we're done with all of this. We finished rearranging all the furniture. Our first journalist is showing up around 8 in the morning, and we're on our way to the elevator together. He left first, and then I left shortly after him. But as I'm walking behind him down the hall on the way to the elevator, I say to myself, I really don't want to get in that elevator with him. I really don't want to get in that elevator with him. But unfortunately, he had pushed the button, and I showed up right behind him, you know, before the elevator came. And we get into the elevator, and he sighs. He goes, ugh. And I simply said, I know how you feel. And he snarled back at me. He said, you don't have any idea how I feel. And I said, you know, you're right. I don't. And then fortunately, his room came up and then my room came up and we separated and then came back in the morning and started our work. So that's one Steve Jobs story. Wow. I'll give you the second half of that, which was he was a big fan of Michael Jackson's, which is probably pretty well known, but he really loved Michael Jackson. And he especially loved the song Billie Jean. And that was back in the day when we had, you know, those tape recorders. What would we call them? Little cassette players, right?
Yeah.
So I knew enough that he loved, you know, Michael Jackson and that song enough to bring the album on a cassette into this room the next day when we were showing the journalists the product. And we had a guy from Fortune coming in, not only the reporter, but also a photographer from Fortune who wanted to take Steve's picture. Steve hated having his picture taken. So he was snarling at the photographer, you know, I won't do that. I won't stand that way. I won't hold this. I won't do this, you know. And so I just very kind of quietly put on the song Billie Jean kind of in the background very quietly. It was about the third or fourth song into the cassette. And he just became like a baby during that song. He became docile. He became, you know, nice. He did what people wanted him to do. And then the song was over with and he'd go back to snarling and being, you know, anxious and nasty. And then I'd rewind the tape, as you had to do back then, and then play it again, and he became docile again. I did this 3 times during that photo shoot, and it's the only reason that that photo shoot turned out relatively well. So there were ways to deal with him if you figured them out.
Wow. That was an incredible couple of stories. Thank you. I appreciate it. I was aware of it that he liked Michael Jackson. I guess I was more aware that he adored Bob Dylan.
Yes. He did both of those people. Yeah.
Yeah, indeed. Thank you, Andy. So, yes, pressing on, 1985, Jobs is ousted by Apple following basically a power struggle with John Sculley, who, ironically, Jobs, as you will, of course, know, brought over from PepsiCo.
Right.
What was that line? Do you want to sell sugar?
You want to continue selling sugar water to children, or would you like to change the world?
There it is. More of that distortion feel at play. So, let's see. And then just to cue this up for our listeners, he goes on to create, as you point out, Next Computer, which focused, I believe it was on higher education and business usage. And that same year, you actually, if my notes are correct here, you left Regis McKenna and created your own firm, Cunningham Communication. Do I have that right? Okay.
Yep.
So here's my question, finally, after all that bluster. Could you please tell me, A, why you decided to start your own firm? I'd love to know. And then B, the difference in working with Jobs at Next versus at Apple, or is it more of the same?
Sure. So when Steve got fired from Apple, you can imagine that I was on the wrong side of the political situation at Apple at that point, because I had been known as his person, right? I was his handler and his PR manager. And I'd always wanted to have my own business my whole life. And so I thought to myself, this is probably as good a time as any to start. I'm young. I'm 28. I got no kids. You know, I was married. My husband and I got married. I met him 100 years ago back in Chicago, and we ended up getting married. And he moved out to California with me, which was lovely. But I decided that was a good time to start my own company because I was on the wrong side of the political thing. And I wasn't going to be able to continue running the Apple account because I was part of the Steve Jobs, you know, get him out of here kind of thing. So I started my own firm. And literally, I was probably maybe 5 days into starting my own firm on my kitchen table in my house. When I get a phone call from Steve saying, hey, it's Steve Jobs. I'm going to have a press conference in about 45 minutes. Can you come over and help me? And I'm like, sure. So I get in my car and I drive over there to his house in Woodside. And the lawn is just milling with probably 100 business press people, Fortune, Forbes, Wall Street Journal, New York Times, San Francisco Chronicle, on a Business Week, all of these publications, right? They're all the reporters who I knew from the last 2 years, just milling around his yard. And I kind of wend my way through them. I get into the kitchen and he's sitting on the floor with seven people who I also knew who were Apple people and his lawyer. And they're all sitting on the floor because there's no furniture in his home at all. So they're sitting on the kitchen floor and the lawyer is sitting right next to him, but saying nothing. And I said, so, Steve, what's happening? And he says, well, I'm going to launch a new company today. I'm going to have a press conference and I'm going to talk about what I'm going to do with this company. I'm calling it Next. I'm taking these seven people with me from Apple. And I also want to tell the world, like, what a jerk John Sculley is. And I'm like, I'm beside myself. You're what? You're going to have a press conference to do all of this? And the lawyer says nothing through any of this, not a word. And I think about it for a second. And I said, Steve, you can't have a press conference today. You don't have a product. You don't even have a company. You have a name for it, but you don't have the company. These people are still at Apple. They're still Apple employees. And you haven't really fully gotten yourself exited out of there either. So it's a bad idea. And it's the worst of this idea is to tell the world what a jerk John Sculley is. That's the worst part. So I recommend you not do this. So he kind of leans back like this. He folds his arm. Lawyer again says nothing. The lawyer said nothing throughout any of this. And he looks up at me after that and he says, okay, I won't do the press conference, but you have to go out there and get rid of everybody. And so I did. I went out there. And by the way, I'm not working with him at this time. He just called me up and asked me a favor. So I go outside and I tell everybody the truth. I said, here's the deal. Steve just got fired from Apple, as you all know. He does want to start another company. He's got a great name for it, but he doesn't have a product. He doesn't have a team. He doesn't have anything to say to you. So I don't think he should talk to you right now, but we will absolutely talk to you the minute there is something to say. But right now, and he's also emotionally connected to all of this, it's just not a good time to be talking to the press. And they mumbled and grumbled, but they all did go home. And then the next day in the Chronicle, there's a reporter who's from kind of an old-fashioned guy from the old days named Herb Kane, very famous in San Francisco, who wrote up a column about it, who called me the PR flack that made all the journalists go home. So, you know, I said, well, you know, that was, I did the right thing. And Steve came around to I did the right thing. And it kind of sent me on another path with Steve. So then he hired me to do the next launch. And then he acquired Pixar. But I will say that he did fire me like five times over the course of the next 3 years. You know, he'd fire me and then a couple months would go by. Then he'd call me to come back. Then he'd fire me and call me to come back. And the final time that he fired me, by this time I had a pretty big agency. You know, I probably had 150 people. And I said, he calls me to bring me back. And I said, Steve, you know, I'm working with your competitor, Taligent. So Taligent was a joint venture between Apple and IBM. It had the very famous nickname of Pink back in the day, but it became a company called Taligent. It was run by an IBM executive named Joe Guglielmi. And they hired me to do the positioning and messaging and PR for them. And I needed it because I had 150 mouths to feed. You know, I couldn't turn down a big account like that.
Right.
So I told him I was working with Taligent, and he was beside himself, livid and angry. How could you possibly work with them? They're the enemy. On and on and on. And I said, I have a business to run, and I have payroll to make, and I need to do this. And so he kind of hung up on me, and I didn't hear from him again for 12 years, maybe 15 years. And the only time I heard from him again is when he became sick, and he reached out to a bunch of people that he had worked with, and I was one of them, with just a very nice email. So that was how it ended with Steve for me.
Wow. Thank you, Annie, for running through all that. I appreciate it. You mentioned Pixar. I'd like to pull that in right now. So yes, Jobs bought Pixar back in 1986 for $10 million from Lucasfilm. And then he brought you, Cunningham Communication, you, on to represent him. I'd love for you to talk about maybe some of the initiatives that you worked on with him at Pixar.
So, yeah, so you may or may not know this. You probably do because you're a historian. But so Pixar was actually a computer company. It was not a storytelling company. So it was a big, it actually looked a lot like the next cube. It was a cube and it was a rendering engine for rendering graphics really quickly.
RenderMan, right?
RenderMan, yeah. So it was a great thing. I mean, it did speed up the rendering of graphics, and it was kind of one of those first tools that the computer graphics that ushered in the age of computer graphics, right? It was a great thing for that. So anyway, So this computer was very impressive. We used to show it off at SIGGRAPH, and, you know, L.B. Ray Smith and Ed Catmull were the two founders of the company. They were and are fabulous people, and just they all had relationships very deeply in the whole world of computer graphics. But it wasn't like it was selling. The market for it was quite small. It was people doing computer graphics for movies, right? And so at that time, weren't a lot of those going on. So Steve noticed there was this, every time that we demoed the product, we had this amazing little demo, you know, that we ran. It was called Luxo Junior, and it was a little story about a lamp, right? But it showed how you could move the graphics around incredibly, and it was short and sweet and emotional. And there was this demo geek in the back guy doing it named John Lasseter. All right. And I think Steve recognized, holy moly, there's something way more here than just this rendering engine. Yes, it does that really well, but this Luxo Junior thing, this is amazing. So he kind of pivoted the company from being the computer to being the storytelling thing that it was, and moved John Lasseter into a, you know, a more storied role than the one he was in. And obviously it did really super well. So it was just really fun working with Pixar. Because when I worked with Pixar, I didn't work that much with Steve. Steve was not trying to control what Pixar was doing for the most part. I mean, that particular thing, that pivot, he did play a big role in that. But he didn't hang over Ed Catmull and L.V. Ray Smith, you know, like a fly telling them what to do. He let them do their own thing. And so I got to work very personally with both of those two guys, you know, without Steve kind of being a part of that.
Sure.
So.
No, thank you. I have a great admiration for Ed Catmull. He's on my bucket list of interviews. I'd read his book, Creativity, Inc., and it's a fascinating read. What was it like working with him, if you don't mind a digression?
No, not at all. Ed Catmull is just a smart, lovely person with a great personality. He could talk to anyone. He didn't have an ego, yet he knew exactly what he was doing. You know, he could carry a conversation with just about anybody. He presented well. He was very excited about what he was doing, so there was a lot of passion in all of his conversations. And I so enjoyed working with him. It was really, really the highlight of, you know, he didn't have the kind of personality that Steve Jobs had. So it was like you playing with him and it was like pleasurable.
Yeah. Wonderful. Well, I'm kind of fascinated here, Andy, because, you know, it would seem to me that you're on what I would perceive to be a very short list of people Steve Jobs liked or at least listened to. That must be, I can't imagine that being a long list. So, not to make you get introspective, but what was it that you think he saw in you that clicked for him or made Steve say, ah, Andy's talking, I better hop too?
Well, I don't think he ever said that. And I think Regis saw this when he offered me the job that first day that I met Regis. I come from Chicago, and there's an image of people who come from Chicago, right? They're Midwestern. Mm-hmm. They're kind of scrappy. They don't care about, you know, money and stuff like that. They're just good, solid humans. Is the reputation we Midwesterners have. And Regis, I think, saw that. And I think he thought that that kind of a personality would get along well with Steve. Because Steve, while not being from the Midwest, he was very much not into power, not into money, very much wanting to change the world, very much scrappy. So I think Regis thought, wow, she could probably get along with him pretty well. And then being a woman, I don't know whether Regis thought this or not, because he never mentioned it. And I never had any female issues with anybody at Apple ever. But I think that possibly being a woman might have been easier for Steve to work with in this capacity than if I had been a man. And Regis probably saw that as well. So anyway, that's how that came to be.
Sure. Yeah, I can understand that. That makes sense to me. So the movie, you're portrayed in the movie Steve Jobs by Sarah Snook, who's fast becoming one of my favorite actresses, I have to say.
She's amazing, isn't she?
Oh, Succession was incredible. I loved her in it.
Yeah.
What was it like seeing yourself on screen? I'd love to know kind of what that experience was like for you.
It was really bizarre. And I got to see the movie in a theater all by myself with my husband. They asked me to come in and screen it, you know, but there was no one else in the theater, just me and my husband. It was the most amazing thing. So I got to see Sarah Snook playing me on the big screen with no one else around. It was such a bizarre thing. But it was, you know, an honor. It was like such an incredible honor to be portrayed in that film. And the funny part about that was meeting Aaron Sorkin earlier, obviously. So I'm in my office and my assistant like says, there's somebody on the phone for you. I said, who is it? And he goes, he tells me he's Aaron Sorkin. And I'm like, no way. Why would Aaron Sorkin call me? There's no way. He said, well, I think it might really be Aaron Sorkin, so you better take this. So I take the call. And sure enough, it's Aaron Sorkin. He explains to me that he's doing a movie based on the Walter Isaacson book. And I don't know whether you knew this or not, but I helped Walter with the book quite a bit.
Yes, I did know that.
Yeah, I made a lot of introductions for him because he didn't know anybody in that industry. And I knew Walter, still know Walter very well because I was a trustee at the Aspen Institute where he was the president. So anyway, so I talking to Aaron, he says, well, I've got an idea for a story here about Steve Jobs. I want to do a movie and I'd love to interview you. And I'm coming to Palo Alto during this time frame. Do you think you could come and spend an hour or so with me? And I said, of course. So I drove down to Palo Alto. I go into the penthouse suite at the Four Seasons in Palo Alto. And I knock on the door and he comes to open it and he goes, Andy or Andrea? And I said, Andy. He goes, okay, tell me this. How long have you been pole dancing? I'm like, what? What are you talking about? And so I kind of laughed it off. I hadn't even come in through the door yet. I kind of laughed it off. Didn't say anything. He goes, come on in. Would you like a cup of coffee? Sure. So I go sit down on the couch and he sticks his hand up in the air and he snaps his finger like this. And like two or three servant type people come out of the woodwork and he wanted a cigarette. And then he says to me, do you mind if I smoke? And I said, well, it is your penthouse. So, what you want to do, but I don't want a cigarette, but a cup of coffee would be great. So we get all that settled. And then he says to me again, how long have you been pole dancing? And I said, I've never pole danced. I said, do I look like a pole dancer? He said, no, I'm just wondering. And then he never brought it up again. And he started to ask me about what it was like to work with Steve. And here's what I think he was thinking. I think because he's a Hollywood guy, I think he thought that publicists have other jobs, if you
will,
besides doing publicity for their clients. But that was so far from anything that ever went on at Apple, at least with Steve, that even if Aaron Sorkin wanted to write that into the script, it would have been unbelievable. So I think this is all my conjecture. I have no idea if this is thought, but I think he abandoned that idea and came up with the other idea that, okay, well, maybe this person is a character that helps Steve, do what Steve needs to do and not a love interest. And so he ended up writing the script. I ended up getting a chance to meet Sarah Snook ahead of time. And I think the way he portrayed me was great. I mean, it's a movie. So there was a lot of things weren't in there and a lot of things that kind of he pushed together that didn't really happen together like that. But I think Aaron did a great job with it. And I'm very saddened that the movie didn't do as well as I think it should have done. And I think that's because Lorraine Jobs, his wife, Steve's wife, didn't like it. She didn't like the book. She didn't like the movie. She didn't like me. She didn't like any of it. So.
Yeah, thank you. I appreciate that. Yeah, I mean, it is a shame. In my opinion, Steve Jobs, that movie is, I think, along with, if you're familiar with the movie Pirates of Silicon Valley.
Yeah.
Yeah, the Noah Wiley thing. Yep. In my opinion, I think those are the two best portrayals of Steve Jobs. Just my opinion as a movie fanatic. Yeah, well,
I loved that movie. It was fabulous. Yeah.
Yeah. Anthony Michael Hall killed it, too.
Hey, did you know there's an opera, a Steve Jobs opera?
No, I didn't.
No, it's coming to San Francisco. It's like days away, I think.
Really?
I saw it down in Santa Fe. It previewed in Santa Fe, the Santa Fe Opera House. And it's based on the movie. And it's really good. There's a lot of it that isn't the same as the movie because it's an opera.
Right.
But you should go see it if this is a topic that interests you. It's very interesting.
Yeah. Thank you for the recommendation. That's Steve Jobs and Opera. Not a sentence I'd hear.
Yeah. I think it's called The Steve Jobs Revolution.
Revolution. I'll look into it. Thank you.
Yeah.
So I feel compelled to ask, what was Sarah Snook like?
Oh, she was just a lovely human, like friendly, sweet. We had lunch together, just like two women having a good time. We had a great time together. And I asked her, how did she come up with the character? Because we didn't spend a lot of time talking about my character. And she said, well, I read a lot about you and I talked to some people and I made the character my own. But it is based on, you and what you did. That's the way I do my thing, is I make the character my own. So, but yeah, we had a very nice time. She's an excellent actress. And that was one of her early things. And that's why, another reason I was disappointed that the movie didn't do so well, because she was so good. But I mean, she wasn't in a starring role. She was just a supporting role. So,
right. Thank you, Andy. I'd love for you to please tell our listeners, to the extent that you haven't already, I don't think we've really covered it, what you've called your framework.
Oh, sure. So,
how's that for a pivot?
Yeah, that's a pivot, but I'll make the segue for you.
Perfect.
I learned a lot from Steve about positioning because the Macintosh was so mispositioned. That's why it didn't work for the first 8 years till he came back, because he positioned it as a business computer to try to compete with the IBM PC. If you remember, he had big signs running around said, no big blue.
So big blue. Right.
Yeah, no big blue. And he really made, he did that ad that he launched, I think in the New York Times or the Wall Street Journal, that said, welcome IBM to the personal computer industry, seriously. Yeah, you know, he was constantly poking fun, constantly poking the bear all the time. And IBM was the bear. And so then he launches this product, and he's like this little nobody from Silicon Valley with a tiny little company. And so he launches this product with the expectation that the thousands of people who just bought IBM PCs were going to throw those away and adopt his Macintosh, which didn't have cursor keys, didn't have networking, didn't have printing, didn't have any of these things, right? So it didn't do well. So I learned about positioning essentially from him originally because it was mispositioned. And Regis was also a very prescient positioner, I guess I would say. So anyway, that's the segue. I became passionate about this concept of positioning because of the Macintosh thing. And I decided to figure out how I actually do. So I became very good at it, by the way, I should say that. I became very good at it and I built a business doing it. But I went into a client one day who was a private equity guy. He'd just taken over a software company. And he says to me, I'm a private equity guy and I know finance, but I don't know software and I don't know marketing. So you tell me you're going to reposition our company here, but what does that really mean? And what are you actually going to do? And no one had ever asked me that before. I thought, I don't know really what to say. I'm going to say what everybody in my business says, which is I'm going to talk to a bunch of people. Then I'm going to sit in a room by myself and be creative and come out with some kind of an answer. And he's like, really? That just, you know, I don't understand that. You know, could you work on what it is you're actually going to do and come back to me? So I did. I took the next 3 days. I locked myself in my office and I reverse engineered what I do when I do this positioning work. And I literally step by step by step. But what I did first is I started with a manual cluster analysis. So I took little yellow stickies and I wrote the name of every company that I had ever worked with. And by this time, I'd been in the consulting business for probably 15 years, 20 years, maybe. So I wrote them all down and I had like 200 different names on these yellow stickies. And I began to sort of cluster them in with like companies that were not by the product that they created, but how they ran the company and how they talked about themselves. And I wound up at the end of several hours of doing this with three piles. I had one pile that was all about total customer focus, one pile that was all around total product focus, and one pile that was around change the world focus, like Apple. And then from there, I took each pile and I did the same thing again. So how do these companies position themselves? If you're a customer-oriented company, how do you actually position yourself? And I discovered, again, by looking at the clients I'd worked with, they either position themselves around a market segment or they position themselves around a customer experience. And then I found two things for the product-oriented things. They're either around value or features. And then the change the world people are all around the next big thing or a cult of personality or both. So now I had a construct. I had a type of company, which I ended up calling a DNA, and I nicknamed them Mothers, Mechanics, and Missionaries because I was writing a book, or I wrote a book later about it. And so I now had a construct. And what I realized is once I had this construct, I was narrowing the options for a company with positioning. So it wasn't like you were just landing in the middle of a giant blue ocean and trying to figure out how to position yourself. Now, if you knew what you were at your core, what your DNA was, and you could figure out how to go forward with positioning. And then I came up with the idea that that's only part of it. Your DNA is only part of it, but it's a critical part and it's probably the most important part. But now there's other parts. So what does context look like for you? What does your community look like? What does your customers look like? What does your competition look like? So I examined each of those, what I call lenses, and created a little bit of a methodology for how you look at your company into the market through those six lenses. And I ended up calling the core, the DNA one core. So anyway, that's the methodology. I wrote the book about it. The book is called Get to Aha. The reason it's called Get to Aha is because when I've done this with companies, at the end of it, they typically go, aha, that's who we are. Right? Everybody's searching for who they are. No, yeah. You know, we all know this as humans, but companies are doing the same thing. Most companies don't know how to articulate who they are or why they matter. So I built a whole business around this methodology, and that's what Cunningham Collective does, my company that I've had now for about 12 years. And I'm working on the second book now, which is called Activating Aha. But the subtitle is How to Hack the Human Condition to Get Things Done. Because people don't like to do something new. They like to keep doing what they were doing. So how do you get them to change?
Absolutely. Absolutely true. Thank you. The reason, if you saw me kind of chuckling, the reason was in the last maybe five or six sentences, you answered my next three questions.
Oh, my God.
So okay. that's economizing. Maybe I'll just say for our listeners, yeah, the full title of the book is Get to Aha, Discover Your Positioning DNA and Dominate Your Competition. Yes. And then my next question I had was, what is the Cunningham Collective? We got there. And then my next question was, what are you currently working on? Which we also got.
There we go. I'm also working on a product, though, I should say. It's called POSMO, which stands for Position of Maximum Opportunity. And it is a product that keeps you lined up with your messaging or your message architecture as you are creating content. So it's a little bit like Grammarly, but it's all focused on your messaging and your message architecture. So,
Interesting. No, thank you. Perhaps one question I have, this isn't on my list, but it occurs to me as you were talking. I'm curious if you've given any thought to how the prevalence of AI now might intrude in your marketing and in your spaces.
Yeah. So, I mean, AI is going to affect everything and everyone. It's kind of like, it's a lot like the internet. So I lived through the internet creation and bubble and all of that. But even after the bubble burst in 2000 on the internet, well, we know what it is today, right? It's everything. So the internet survived, even though the economic bubble kind of burst. We're in the same situation right now with AI. Everything is going to be affected by it. And long after the bubble bursts, it will continue to have a giant effect on everything and everyone. So everybody is looking for how are they going to be an AI company, right? Just like back in the late 90s, they were looking at how are they going to be an internet company. Now they're looking at how am I going to be an AI company. So I'm working with some companies in that space that are actually developing AI technologies. I'm working with a new chip company, which is really, really cool. It's a company called Grok. And they basically make a microprocessor or a processor, if you will, that is called the language processing unit. So it's the next step beyond the graphics processing unit, which is what we have today, which is what NVIDIA makes. But NVIDIA made this chip for the graphics industry, for the gaming industry, you know, 20 years ago. And it's fabulous. It's an incredible processor. They did a fabulous job with it. But AI requires even faster speeds than what they are able to achieve with the GPU. So that's what the next big thing is going to be, faster processing. And we think Grok has it with the LPU. So I'm just excited about AI. I'm on the AI is going to wind up mostly for good. Yes, there'll be some bad stuff coming out of it, but mostly it's going to do good.
I think I would feel as you do. I suppose time will tell.
Yes. Yes.
Perhaps my last question for you, Andrea, how can people find out about you?
Well, my website at cunninghamcollective.com is at one good place. I have a Wikipedia page for Andy Cunningham. I go by Andy, so it's always Andy. And you can always reach out to me at andy@gettoaha.com. And that's Andy at GET2AHA.com. And I'm on Twitter and Facebook and LinkedIn and all of that as well.
Excellent. Excellent. Andy, I really enjoyed speaking with you. I appreciate you taking the time for me. Thank you.
Oh, thank you, Josh. This was really fun. Really fun.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Podcast too, about going forward. I love the idea of the history. It's great.
That's really kind of you. I appreciate that. If you like, I'll send you some of my favorites.
Yeah, that'd be great. Send me your favorites. I'd love it.
I will. Awesome. Awesome, Andy. I will not keep you any longer. I really appreciate your time.
All right, Josh. Thank you so much. Have a great weekend.
Thanks, Andy. You too. I appreciate it.
Thanks. Bye.
Bye.
Thanks for listening to this episode. If you'd like to support Eyewitness History, the easiest way to do that would be to subscribe to the show on the podcast player of your choice and leave a review. For more information on Eyewitness History, along with show notes and links to resources, go to ParthenonPodcast.com, where you can also listen to some other great podcasts by the Parthenon Podcast Network, such as Scott Rank's History Unplugged, Steve Guerra's History of the Papacy, James Early's Key Battles of American History, and Richard Lim's This American President, along with many others. Thank you.
The Historical Jesus Podcast is the sweeping saga of the life and times of Galilean Jesus of Nazareth, as well as the faith, religion, and church founded to honor and disseminate his acts and teachings. Join me, Mark Vinette, on this fascinating journey through time, exploring the many great works of Christian theology, literature, architecture, music, and art inspired by the words and deeds of Jesus Christ.